We'd like to thank those that listen to these talks by downloading them from iTunes or as podcasts or from our own website. They're welcome to correspond with us at our email address, utahkrishnas@gmail.com. We also have a membership class online at our website, utahkrishnas.org. Welcome to take that, and we'd like to thank those that have become members because we couldn't do what we do without your help and support. Everything is inspired on the teachings of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the founder, Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. I'd like to talk to you today about confidential knowledge. If you put God first place in your life, you have a huge advantage over those that don't. One of the advantages is that you don't have to go through life guessing about specifics in your life. You don't have to guess about what city to live in, what vocation to follow, what girl or boy to marry, how to use your finances, because you're going to be privy to inside information that people who live in the natural are not able to access. It's explained in the Bhagavad Gita that the Lord, being omnipotent, can expand Himself unlimitedly. That means that He can be fully present in each and every atom of His creation, fully present in each and every heart. And His original form is not in any way diminished thereby. On the absolute platform, if you take one away from one absolute truth, you still have one. One minus one, you still have one. Me, if I have $100 and I give you $10, then my original stock is reduced to $90. But the absolute truth can expand Himself fully and at the same time not lose anything thereby. On an August or a July day, if you ask everyone where the sun is, everyone will say the sun is on my head. The sun is at one point in the sky. It's one indivisible entity many, many millions of miles away. At the same time, that same sun, in a sense, is on our head. So God is one. At the same time, He's distributed within the hearts of every living being. So what this means is that inside of our bodies is the creator of millions and millions of universes. He knows past, present, and future. He knows everything about everything and everyone. So what a great reference point. It's like having the internet multiplied millions and millions of times over. And it has characteristics of character building and benevolence and long-term good also built into it. Of course, we don't qualify for, nor would we want to have everything downloaded. We just don't have big enough hard drives or software to accommodate that. But the Lord promises that if we are sensitive to the transmissions that He's constantly sending us from within the heart, He will give us whatever knowledge we need, not only general knowledge, but specific knowledge at junctures of our lives to get us to where we need to go. And we need this supernatural guide, we need this supernatural counsel in order to achieve everything that we're meant to achieve and to fulfill the destiny that He has in mind for us. So there's no question that God's always trying to get through to us. He's always transmitting instruction, advice, counseling, guidance. The only question is, are we receiving it? Are we tuned in to His frequency? Or is it that we've always got our iPods in our ear and we've got our cell phone, we've got the TV on, and when God's trying to get through to us, He's constantly getting rebuffed by a busy signal. You know, we may not find that some of the things that that deep, small voice within inside of us tells us, it may not be so palatable to our mind. Our mind may tell us to do something else. Our emotions may tell us to do something else. Well, I don't feel like doing that. I know it's right, but I don't feel like doing that. Other people may counsel us otherwise. But if we listen faithfully, if we make ourselves receptive to and adherence of that small, deep voice that comes from within our hearts, it will get us where we need to go and do us the most benefit in the long run. Prabhupada once compared the ears of the human being to the ears of the elephant. The elephant has big, big ears. But the ears of the elephant are not meant for understanding the transmissions of God's instructions. If you take a subhuman body, although you're an eternal spirit soul, comprised originally just as we are, the animal body is not attuned to the message of God. There's very little choice, there's very little range of options available to the animals. By the stringent laws of material nature, they're dictated to 24 hours a day, fulfilling the necessities of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. We, however, have a lot of choices that face us, and it's very important that we make good decisions. Not only good decisions, but if we can make great decisions, we can have a great life. And so it's a matter of being sensitive to the messages that the Lord has sent us, both in a general sense through scriptures, which are available to everyone, and also in a specific sense that he's speaking to you and to you and to you specifically as individuals in the various junctions of your lifetime. Classic example of someone who ignored the still deep voice of God is Ravana. If you're familiar with the Ramayana, when Ravana was dying, Ram told his brother Lakshman to go to Ravana and get whatever advice he could from the dying man. So with his dying words, Ravana said, on the one hand, I had the technology to make from salt water fresh water. I could do it economically. I could do it wholesale. I could have actually solved for all time the problem of drought and unhygienic drinking water on the whole planet of the earth. So the little voice told me, this is good, you should do it right away. But I ignored it. On the other hand, I conceived an attraction, an infatuation for another man's wife, none other than Sita, the consort of Lord Ramachandra. That same little voice said, this is not good. This is not good. Don't do it. Put this off indefinitely. I ignored the voices. I ignored the voice that told me to do the auspicious thing immediately. I ignored the voice that told me to put off the inauspicious thing. I put that off. Now I'm dying. It remains undone. Instead, I rushed against the advice of my indwelling guide and spirit to steal Ram's wife. And here I am dying. My kingdom is destroyed. My army is dispersed. And everything is lost. So Krishna will warn you when there's something bad up ahead. If you're old enough to have looked back on certain decisions and choices in your life that you now regret, you will undoubtedly also recall that there was a little voice telling you, watch out, don't go there, don't do that, you'll regret it. But we repressed it. The alarm was going off, but we went and put it on snooze. God can give us not only, as I said, general information, but he can give us specific information about our family, about our career. I was thinking of water because of that instance of Ravana. I read that the pioneers used to cross the great Midwestern plains, states like Nebraska and Kansas. And although the soil was dark, people deemed it a barren wasteland, an irredeemable place of the earth. And they couldn't wait to get across the central plains to get to California, Oregon, or the coastal regions. And many people died for lack of water and other resources during the crossing. At some point, I don't have a name to put to it, but a little small voice inside of someone said, why don't you drill? Why don't you dig down and just see what's there? And lo and behold, when they drilled in Nebraska, they found an underground aquifer that was two-thirds the size of the entire state of Nebraska. And because of someone heeding that small, still voice inside of them, the great barren wasteland of the Midwest literally became the breadbasket for the entire world. Now, how do I know, how do I know that there's some less than benign voice? How do I know that it's not the voice of the enemy, in fact, overriding that still quiet voice? Well, consider your motives. Is it a matter of finding reasons to eat that dessert that you shouldn't have? Is it rationalizing a lapse of ethics to cheat and pass that test in school, bring that client on board? Does it have to do with buying a car I can't afford just for the show-off factor? Is it a get-rich-quick scheme because I'm too lazy to earn an honest living by earnest work? Or is it because I want to put God first place in my life, enrich and revive my relationship with Him, and thereby assist all other living beings to attain higher and higher levels of satisfaction and spirituality? If your motives are in the latter category, then yes. That voice that you're hearing is none other than the genuine voice of the Lord. If it's in the former category, it is the enemy. It is a deluding, misleading voice of a different nature altogether. So we need to be very careful about our motives, our purity, our intentions. Sometimes the course that another person has taken is so obviously wrong, and there's so many alarm going. It's like sometimes you'll be looking out in an intersection and you'll see a car going in the intersection, and before the driver even sees it, you say, "Oh my gosh!" You know, and you just hunch down and you brace for the sound of the crash. And sure enough, it comes a few minutes later. Sometimes God can use us to be a conduit to give advice and to perhaps bring about a change of direction in someone else's life. This is not to say that we should poke our nose where it's not wanted or not mind our own business, but sometimes there are instances when that transmission is delivered through another person. There's a funny story of Mark Twain in Boston. He was in Boston and a man came up to him who was known as a ruthless, unethical businessman. And this man said to Mark Twain, he said, "I had an inspiration the other day. I had an inspiration to make a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, to climb up to Mount Sinai, and on the very spot where it's believed that Moses received the Ten Commandments from God, I wanted to recite the Ten Commandments." Mark Twain said, "I've got a better idea. Why don't you just stay in Boston and keep the Ten Commandments?" I told this story a few weeks ago also, just to recapitulize it in 25 words or less. Ben Hooper was born the illegitimate son of a lady of loose morals in a small Baptist town in Tennessee. And all his life he was made feel guilty by virtue of the fact that he didn't know who his father was. He dragged his feet, he thought the less of himself, he didn't do well in school. And when the weekly church services occurred at the Baptist church, he would go in late, sit in the back, and as soon as the sermon was over, he'd try to jet out the front door in order to avoid the judgmental, accusatory gazes of the narrow-minded Baptists in that town. One week, there was a guest preacher, and when the sermon was over, he made a beeline for the door, but it was bottlenecked, and a hand clapped him on the shoulder. He looked up and there was the last person he wanted to see, the guest preacher, looking down at him. And the guest preacher said, "Whose boy are you?" The boy turned crimson. He wanted to disappear, melt into the floorboards. He was so embarrassed. And then the preacher said, "I know whose boy you are. You're the son of the Almighty God. I recognize the family resemblance. Why don't you pick up your feet, throw your shoulders back, start looking people in the eye, and begin to fulfill the destiny that your loving father wants for you?" And indeed, Ben Cooper did exactly as he was advised, and later on he became elected as the governor of Tennessee. This was a transmission that came to him that changed his life, and the conduit was someone else. I love this phrase. Very, very short, very pithy, but I'm going to repeat it twice because I think it's so full of import. When you know the cause of all causes, everything becomes known and nothing remains unknown. Isn't that good? When you know the cause of all causes, everything becomes known and nothing remains unknown. That doesn't mean I know how many fingers you're hiding behind your back. But it means when I'm connected with the Lord and when I'm sensitive to His transmissions, whatever I need, whatever wisdom I need to make great decisions will be supplied to me. I don't need all the wisdom that God has. I don't need to know everything that He knows. I couldn't download all that. It would cause my system to crash. But His promise is that He'll give us whatever we need in any given situation. If you know 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, if you know those digits, 1 through 9, pretty much you've got all of mathematics before you. Because most of mathematics is just a combination of those various digits. Consider Prabhupada, our spiritual master, whose statue is there and there. He was charged with his guru in India to come to America and bring about a spiritual revitalization. He arrived in America in 1965, right in the teeth of the hippie revolution. Young kids were smoking pot, they were dropping LSD according to the advice of a Harvard professor, and they believed in free love. And here comes a 7-year-old man who's meant to bring about a total moral and spiritual revitalization. How is he going to do that? Well, let's look at it in retrospect. He did it. How did he do it? How does he communicate? What does he say to these young hippies in their teens and their 20s who think they know everything and think that LSD is the secret, the elixir to unlock all the doors of life? How does he do that? Communication. Inside the word communication is common. That's how we communicate. The more things we have in common, if we have youth in common, that facilitates communication. If we're from Norway, when we meet other people from Norway, that facilitates communication. There were some visitors from Russia at the temple last night. They attended the 7 o'clock services, and Banamali talked to them till 12:15 at night. Communication means we have things in common that we can talk about. So what did a 70-year-old Indian man have in common from a cultural, ethnic, or genetic point of view with hippies in the Haight-Ashbury? Nothing from any of those points of view. But what we all have in common is the indwelling Lord within our hearts. So God gave him the words. He gave him the charisma. He gave them the allure by which thousands and thousands of those young people, myself included, gave up illicit sex, gambling, intoxication, meat eating in the interest of furthering their spiritual life. And there's one funny story to show, just to kind of hint at how connected Prabhupada was to the indwelling spirit within all living beings. This is a picture of an initiation ceremony. At the time of initiation, when one decides to dedicate one's life to the mission of the spiritual master, one receives beads from the spiritual master on which he promises to chant 16 rounds a day. And at that time, the spiritual master tells him what his spiritual name is. My name was Chris, and when I got initiation, Prabhupada anointed me as Chiru. So there's a story of one devotee, not very well educated, simple devotee. He was sitting in line to get initiated. This might have been 72, 73, 74. And Prabhupada initiates, he gives one devotee his beads. He says, your name is Gopijana Vallabha. Your name is Gopinath Acharya. Your name is Yudhisthira Das. Your name is Anakundum Dubi. That was a little of an exaggeration. So this devotee is saying, he's getting terrified. He said, if I get one of those 3 or 4 syllabic names, I don't know what I'll do. I'll just forget it. I won't be able to pronounce it. He was just getting in a panic, thinking it's something that he would never be able to deal with in his lifetime. So when his turn came up, Prabhupada gave him the beads, and he said, your name is Gopal. And Prabhupada spelled it for him. He said, G-O-P-O-A-A-L. And then he said, is that all right? Another example of the prescience of the Almighty took place in the Kurukshetra War. Arjuna was a champion of the forces of good, but his most dangerous and lethal opponent was Karna. And Krishna knew that on a given day, Karna could beat Arjuna. As the chariot driver of Arjuna, Krishna intentionally drove Arjuna's chariot to places in the battlefield where Karna was not. Now Arjuna wanted to face Karna, to face his most formidable opponent and get it out of the way. So he kept telling Krishna, take me to Karna, take me to Karna. And Krishna would, he just played dumb. I can't find him, I can't find him. We'll try again tomorrow, we'll try again tomorrow. But Krishna knew that in the early stage of the battle, Karna had advantages by which he would be able to kill Arjuna. And so Krishna deferred the inevitable confrontation by going to other parts of the battlefield. One of the advantages is that Karna had been given a javelin, which was infallible. Whoever that javelin was thrown towards or targeted, that javelin would hit the destination and destroy without any fallibility. So Krishna was waiting until one day of the battle, Ghatotkacha got so powerful, he was so much infused with power, again by the Lord who directs all living beings, that Ghatotkacha was decimating the whole Kaurava army. And they came to Karna and they said, you have got to throw that javelin at Ghatotkacha. He said, I'm saving it for Karna. He said, nope, nope. If you don't throw the javelin at Ghatotkacha, he's going to annihilate our whole army tonight. There won't be any tomorrow in which to save your... And so he released the javelin and killed Ghatotkacha. Now, it came to the 15th day of the battle, and many soldiers had died, a lot of blood had been shed, and the place was mired. It was literally muddy and sticky and gooey. And Krishna knew, being the Lord of all things, that on the following day, Karna's wheel of his chariot would get stuck in the mud. And finally, having been bereft of the javelin, having got his chariot stuck in the mud, finally Krishna drew the chariot parallel and confrontational to Karna. When God takes your side, he gives you protection. Protection doesn't necessarily mean something dramatic, you know, like a lightning bolt from the sky. Direction is protection. You might have had the experience of taking the same route to work every day for years and years, and one day you just get this little still voice that says, go a different way. Go a different way. And later on in the evening news, you read about a horrific multi-car accident that happened along the route that you normally take. Or you might have heard a similar story from someone else. So protection, direction can be protection as well. And if we'll stay tuned to that small, still voice of God within ourselves, we'll have insight to know things that in the natural we would never know. Another story about Prabhupada at the beginning of the movement, we had no books, and without books, Prabhupada didn't think we could spread the teachings of Krishna consciousness. And there was very little money, just a few followers. So unless a big publishing house in New York, like Random House or Collier or Macmillan, would agree to publish the Bhagavad Gita, it just wasn't going to get done. And Brahmananda, who was the secretary of Prabhupada, had already been to all the publishing houses and asked them if they would publish the Bhagavad Gita. They all said no. They weren't interested in a spiritual religious interpretation. They wanted something more scholarly or more secular. So they got a purchase order from Collier Macmillan. They'd done a record, a 33 and a third LP called Transcendental Meditations. And Collier Macmillan was also doing in the music business. So they sent a purchase order for one record. And Prabhupada told Brahmananda, take the record and deliver it and take the manuscript of the Bhagavad Gita and ask them to publish it. And Brahmananda said, but Prabhupada, I've already been over there a bunch of times. They always said no. Prabhupada said, take the record, deliver it, and take the manuscript and ask them to publish it. And Brahmananda said, well, I'm just taking one record to the accounting department, picking up a check for $10. I'm not going to be on the 25th floor where the decision makers are. Prabhupada said, take the record, take the purchase order, take the manuscript, and ask them to publish it. So Brahmananda, in spite of all of his doubts, all of his misgivings, everything in his mind was telling him negatively, everything that his emotions were going against, he went into the basement accounting areas, talking with some lowly accountant, giving him the record, picking up his $10 check. He's got the manuscript of the Bhagavad Gita under his arm, and lo and behold, it just so happened that from the 25th floor, on some errand or other, one of the major executives of Collier Macmillan walked into the accounting office. He looked at Brahmananda's tilak, he looked at his korte, he looked at his dhoti, and then he looked at the manuscript under his arms, and he said, that wouldn't by any chance be the Bhagavad Gita, would it? And Brahmananda said, yeah. He says, amazing. I have just been promoted to published our Eastern Classics department. And I was wondering where I could get a new Bhagavad Gita to publish as part of this series. Come into my office, let's talk about that. So Prabhupada knew, or he intuited it. If you'd asked Prabhupada, how did you know? He wouldn't have had data or research to back it up. He would have just said, I knew because I knew. I knew because the Almighty Lord, the creator of millions and millions of universes, the super soul, the knower of past, present, and future, the cause of all causes, is in my heart. And I listened to that small, still voice. And that's how I knew. From a research point of view, there's no way there could be a Hare Krishna temple in Utah Valley. If we had engaged a research company to investigate the feasibility of a Hare Krishna temple in Utah Valley, where 90% of the people are Mormons, they would have given us thumbs down. No way, you'll fall on your face. This is a bad idea. And yet, Bhai Bhavi and I had this voice prompting us in our heart. Go ahead, do it, try it. God is saying, I will go before you. I will make the crooked places straight. I will send the people across your path that you need. Don't worry, though you may have critics, though you may have naysayers, though you may have detractors, though circumstances don't look conducive, though the research does not support it or the data bear it out, go ahead and do it. And we even had people in our own movement. We were living in Los Angeles at the time. And when I shared them this dream of purchasing a radio station, and well, that was earlier, and going to Utah and building the temple, we had opposition from our own co-religionists. We had stumbling blocks put in our path. And yet we couldn't ignore that persistent voice in our hearts and in our souls that said, go ahead, don't worry about it, I will pave the way. And when people visit it now, of course, it's a well-established tourist destination. And there are three things that make this a wonderful tourist destination. One is the temple itself. Bhai Bhavi did a magnificent job designing it and organizing the construction of it. Two is the location. We've got a 15-acre plot in South Utah County with an elevated position for the temple. You couldn't have a better place to put a temple. But the third thing is when people walk through the door, they're attracted by the building, they're attracted by its location, but the first words that come out of most people's mouths when they walk through the door is, how did this get here? This is so unlikely that a Krishna temple would be an area that's 90% Mormon. Nothing against the Mormon. They're great people. But their religion requires a lot of dedication, commitment. There just isn't anything left over. And why should there be anyway for the Krishna conscious point of view? And when people ask me, you know, I say, do you want the short answer or the long one? Give me the short answer. I say, look at Krishna with a peacock feather in his hair, standing with his flute to his lips, jauntily in the threefold bending form. He's a prankster. He's a prankster. He did it just to show he could do it. He parted the Red Sea to show he could do it. He planted a Krishna temple in an area that's 90% Mormon just to show that he could do it. So we couldn't ignore the promptings from within to just go ahead, follow through. Don't worry. Don't lose sleep over it. It may not make sense to your mind. It may not make sense to your emotions. It may not be supported or validated by other people. But as long as we have the support of Almighty God, then why should we worry about other these concerns? As well as prompting us as to what we should do, we will have the gift of discernment as to who to avoid. Because not everyone is who they seem. Not everyone is who they present themselves to be. There's a statement that says, if you walk with the wise, you'll become wise. But who keeps companies with fools suffer harms. The first statement is a promise. The second statement is a warning. It's a promise. This will happen. If you associate with wise people, you will become wise. Wisdom is infectious. Wisdom is contagious. If you keep company with fools, you'll experience harm. It's not saying that if you keep companies with fools, you'll become a fool. It's saying that from their bad choices, anyone who's near them, anyone who's in their proximity is going to experience the fallout from their bad choices. The shrapnel. Doesn't mean that you become full in their company. A lot of people will rationalize hanging around with old friends that they've far outstripped, with people that are going in a different direction in life. They'll rationalize it by saying, well, I don't believe the things they do. I don't do the things they do. I keep my own counsel. But if you're in their association, I know people that will never walk again because they were in a car with a fool. People who will never see again. People whose reputation is slandered because they hung out with the wrong, loose-tongued people. A fool is not necessarily someone who doesn't know the consequences of their actions. A fool is someone who may know and be very well aware, but doesn't care. A fool is someone you can go up to and say, if you do that, do you know that what that's going to do to your marriage? And he's not going to say, thank you, I never thought of that. Oh, you saved my life. No. He's going to say, I know, but I don't care. Do you realize that a sedentary lifestyle, do you realize what that's going to do to your physical and emotional well-being in the future? Yeah, I know, but I don't care. Do you know what your spending habits are going to do? Do you know the hole they're going to put you in due course of time, the agony and suffering that they're going to cause? Yeah, but I don't care. And you know what? If they don't care about their finances, they're not going to care about your finances. If they don't care about preserving their marriage, they're not going to care about preserving your marriage. If they don't care about their own physical health and well-being, they don't care about your physical health and well-being either. So when we're in touch with that small, silent voice, call it the spirit or the conscience or whatever, the super soul, we'll get the gift of discernment to stay away from those people that we should not be in their association. Some people have ulterior motives. They want to be your friend for what you can do for them. There are people out there who are takers and not givers. Once they use you up, they will move on to someone else. Here's a picture of Bernard Madoff, who built people for $50 billion. Now, all the pundits, all the financial analysis, and all the stock exchange people, none of them were able to intuit that this guy was not on the level. He fooled all the experts who were looking at him from the natural point of view. On the other hand, there were people, they were cajoled, they were encouraged by their friends. You got to get into this. This is a great thing. This is your chance. But there was some unrest. They were listening to a little voice that said, no, everything is not right here. They couldn't exactly say why or put their finger on it, but they just felt that this was not something that they should just follow the crowd or be swept up in the emotion of it or the excitement. The guy was so shrewd. He sat on the boards of many charities. He gave liberally to a lot of philanthropic institutions. He wouldn't take investment money from individuals. He would only take it if you went through a corporate structure. And his return was 1% a month or 12% a year. Now, there were legitimate funds that were giving more than that back. So no one realized the depth of the scandal of the scheme that he had mounted. Not in the natural, but there were people. I know a family in Los Angeles, they lost $2 million to this guy. The son is one of the most shrewd financial people that you'll ever know. The guy is a genius. He invested money and he started getting returns, and then he advised his dad, you invest. So he had put in $1 million, they lost $2 million. But there are other people that listen to that small, still voice of discernment, and boy, they must be happy now. Thank you, Lord, for being my guide, for being my mentor. We generally get in trouble because we want to follow our ways and we want to ignore God's ways. He'll only advise us. He's not going to take our arm and twist it up behind our back and force us to do the right thing. He'll guide us, but he will not force us. We have to do our part to, number one, listen, and number one, adhere and follow the Lord of the universe. He can see the big picture that we can't see. He can see around the corner and the dead end. He can see that as a result of the choice that we make now, he can see misery and suffering coming 10, 20, 30 years down the line. He can see things that we can't see, and he always has our best interests at heart. There may be an opportunity that looks just great, but there's something inside you that causes a hitch, that causes you to hesitation, and that may be a good opportunity. But this may not be the right time. You may be a girl and you see a boy and he's hot and he's good looking, and he's got money and he seems nice. Or you may be a girl who sees a boy who's hot and good looking, or a boy who sees a girl, and it just may seem like the fulfillment of all your fantasies and all your dreams. But there's something inside that says, watch out and be careful. Something inside that says you need to make a good decision right now. You need to consult the Lord in your heart. Because if you make the wrong decision, you can waste whole seasons of your life. If you make the right decision, you can profitably spend whole seasons of your life. Sometimes lust and infatuation are not the impetuses that we should pursue in the long term. I read something where the best marriages, the most deep love affairs, the most longly sustained affairs between men and women are between those that are less celebrated, who have less of a sizzle factor, and who make less of a big first impression. Oftentimes, the most successful marriages, you ask, where did you guys meet? And they'll tell you where they met, but they'll also say, when I met her or when I met him, I didn't remember. That when we met the second time, I had to be reminded of the first meeting. So they weren't swept off their feet. There weren't fireworks. It wasn't lust at first sight. It was an unremarkable first meeting for apparently an unremarkable first person. But they say still waters run deep. Character and commitment are much more favorable qualities for love and for a long-term commitment than the sizzle factor of good looks, good body, hot, good car, money, and so on and so forth. So there are instances when we need to heed that still small voice in order to save ourselves a lot of heartbreak. We shouldn't misunderstand that God's not trying to take anything away from you. He's just trying to keep you from heartache and from grief and pain, and he's trying to get you to a better place than we would go in the natural. He's trying to get us to a place that we could never even dream of. Pay attention if there's tension. If there's something in your finances that bothers you, something in your relationships, there's something in your lifestyle. If there's a tension there, there's a reason that that tension is there. God put that tension there to make you stop and take a second look at it, to calm down, to be peaceful, and to make the right decision. We need goals, we need ambitions, we need to achieve things in life, we need to make a difference. But we need to do it with the talents and abilities that God gave us. We need to run our own race. We can't be swayed by what the person on the right of us is doing or the person on the left of us is doing. We can't be wanting to be someone else. We have to stay within ourselves, run our own race, and be peaceful. So in the making of this decision and this choice, am I going to be peaceful? Or is it just not going to be me? Is it going to cause too much stress and too much over-endeavor? Alarms may be going off, but don't turn them off. Don't override that voice which is coming deep from within your soul. When you feel unrest, it's not that Krishna or God is trying to take something from you. He's trying to get you to an area or a level that's much better. The very last verse in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is trying to get you out of something. And if you just took this verse out of context, you would be shocked, appalled. Let me tell you the verse and then you'll know what I'm saying. Krishna says, Sarva Dharman Parityaga. This is basically his last advice to the Bhagavad Gita. Sarva Dharman Parityaga. The translation is, give up all varieties of religion. He's saying Catholics, Hindus, Muslims, Jews, Mormons, give it all up. Give it all up. Well, someone said, well, oh boy, that's a formula for mayhem. What if we didn't have religion? What if we didn't have people that went to church and believed in the moral code, thou shalt not steal, and thou shalt not... And in fact, that is a positive alternative from something else. That was a step up from something else. We gave up something else in order to become a card-carrying member of religion. But Krishna doesn't want to keep us there. He wants to take us further. He wants to take us to the eternal spiritual world where life is eternal, full of bliss and knowledge. And he knows that as long as you identify yourself in sectarian denominational terms, as long as you think of yourself as a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or a Hindu, you are denied entrance to the eternal spiritual world of God. In that world, there are no Muslim, Christian, Hindu neighborhoods. There's no sectarian denominational mentality. There is only love of God. So the full verse is, if we go on, Krishna says, give up all varieties of religion, sarvadhammam parityaja, and then he says, mam ekam saranam braja, aham samsarvabha, mokshyasi mam sucha. So he's not trying to take something away from us without giving us something better. He says, give up all varieties of religion and just surrender to me. I will protect you from all sinful reaction. Do not fear. He's asking us to graduate from a religion to a relationship. And it's only when we have a revised, revitalized relationship with God that we actually join Him in the eternal spiritual world to live a life of eternality, bliss, and knowledge. And Krishna never advises to get stuck in this material world and to buy into the mores and customs and ambitions of society in general. He doesn't want us to be conformed by society. Prahlad Maharaj, a great wise devotee of the Lord, he said the greatest cause of unhappiness is trying for happiness. The greatest cause of unhappiness is trying for happiness. When society tells you you need this and you need this and you need to drive that and you need to live in that to be happy, that is the greatest cause of unhappiness. Because whatever God set aside for you, whatever has your name on it is already there. You simply have to claim it. Nothing can keep you from what God has prepared you to do. Your bags are packed. You're fully equipped to do what it was that God created and intended you to do. So we don't need to waste time and energy following and pursuing the Maya Sukhaya, the false happiness of a consumeristic society. I love this poem by William Burroughs. Serene I fold my hands and wait, nor care for wind or tide nor sea. I rave no more against time or fate, for lo, my own shall come to me. I stay my haste, I make delays, for what avails this eager pace? I stand amid the eternal ways, and what is mine shall know my face. Asleep, awake, by night or day, the friends I seek are seeking me. No wind can drive my ship astray, nor change the tide of destiny. What matter if I stand alone? I wait with joy the coming years. My heart shall reap where it hath sown and garner up its fruit of tears. The waters know their own and draw the brook that springs in yonder heights. So flows the good with equal law unto the soul of pure delight. The stars come nightly to the sky, the tidal wave into the sea. Nor time, nor space, nor deep, nor high can keep my own away from me. Let God lead you. Don't try to have it your own way. He will take you to places where you'll experience explosive blessing. Sometimes we are pursuing the right thing, but it's at the wrong time. For many years, after we built this temple, we opened this temple in 2001, we had this beautiful world-class temple on the top of the hill, but there was a dirt road leading up to the temple with potholes. At that time, asphalt was about $6 a square foot. And people would come up to me and they would tell me, "True, when are you going?" They would be bouncing and their teeth would be rattling, say, "When are you guys going to asphalt the road?" And we kind of had the money almost, but it would have literally bankrupted us to do it. And there was just something in me that said, God wasn't telling me not to asphalt the road, but he was telling me, don't do it now. And there was someone in the temple that was just criticizing me, Chiru's hoarding money, you know. If I were in charge instead of Chiru, that road would have been asphalted a long time ago. If I were in charge instead of Chiru, this is what I would do. And this went on day after day after day after day after day. But there was a voice that caused me to dig in my heels and be stubborn about it and just not do it. A couple years later, the economic downturn came. Asphalt went from $6 a square foot to $1.50. So instead of spending $65,000 to pave the road, we paved the road for $18,000. So let God lead you. It may be a good thing, but it may not be the right time. Or if it's a good thing and it doesn't happen, God closes that door, it means he's got something much, much better for you. Whatever you're intended to have, nothing can keep that from you. They've got your name on them. No person, no circumstances can keep them from you. At the right time, he may make it happen. You may have had closed doors, missed opportunities in the past. Don't worry about it. It either wasn't the right time or Krishna had something even better planned for you in the future. Go out each day knowing that you have inside information. You have the Lord of millions and millions of universes who knows past, present, and future, who has your best interest at heart living right inside of you. He's an advisor, a counselor, a friend. He's the super soul of the universe. If there's a tension there about a certain decision, God put it there. Pay attention to the tension. Don't override what you're feeling and hearing in your soul. That's God talking to you, who knows what's best. When you have a decision to make, let peace be a deciding factor. If you know how to follow this lead of the Lord, who is almighty, he promises he will guide your steps with wisdom. He will help you make great decisions and take you to places that you could have never even dreamed of on your own. And if you'd like to chant with me, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.